I'm calling this talk The Protections of Loving Kindness. I follow D.L. Hughley on Instagram, and the other day he had a clip of a commencement address given by the governor of Illinois at Northwestern University. And it was really, really interesting. It was very short, but it really grabbed me. And let me just give you a gist of what he said. And I don't know how I feel about this first sentence, but it grabbed my attention and it was intriguing. And then the way he talked about it afterward, I found I liked. He said, "The best way to spot an idiot, look for the person who is cruel." Best way to spot an idiot, look for the person who's cruel. And basically what he was talking about was that people who are cruel are often driven by fear, driven by judgment, driven by those types of emotions and feelings. And those are old, old, old animal instincts. Those are the old, you know, fight, flight, freeze that we had when we were, you know, crawling around, that reptiles still have, you know, looking for the prey and reacting whether something seems safe or unsafe. And so it's this real non-evolved kind of reactivity, instinctual reactivity. And he said that empathy and compassion are more evolved states of being. You know, and it really struck me. He said that our society believes weaponized cruelty is a master plan, and empathy and kindness are weak. And it's really easy to see that, because if you look at the meanness in today's discourse, in political discourse and social discourse, if you spend any time on social media, you see that it's all about gotcha, 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 which is really a place of meanness, a place of, you can say, cruelty. It's trying to really one-up the other person and push the other person down, whoever it is. And we saw, you know, this week, all the heartbreaking decisions handed down by the Supreme Court, which had a real flavor of meanness to them. A real flavor of meanness to them. So it's kind of seeped into all areas of our culture these days. Not that it's new, but it's just kind of really in our face these days. And he said that cruelty is a way to gain power. And as I said, it's not new. It's been that way for years, thousands of years actually. If you study history at all. And he said that acts of cruelty show we fail the test of an advanced society which has never evolved past instinctual fears. That fear of the other, the fear of something different from ourselves, something that differs from how we believe or how we act or how we've taught, instead of being curious and being open and being friendly, we immediately try to squish it or smash it, or do something to destroy it. He said that it's never forced the animal brain to evolve or forge new mental pathways, you know? And that is what really intrigued me, because that's what we're doing in practice. We're forging new mental pathways beyond this reactivity of, ooh, if it's good, I want it. If it's bad, I don't want it. And when you slow the mind down in mindfulness, you begin to see that. And then he said two more things. He said their thinking, people who are still cruel, their thinking and problem solving will lack the creativity and imagination that the kindest people have, because they're so stuck in this small little view of the world. I gave a talk a week or two ago about this kind of thing, where we're just, you know, last week I gave a talk on beginner's mind, which is really this, what is this, instead of being stuck in our preconceived notions. And then the last thing I'll mention is that the kindest person in the room is often the smartest, is often the one that can see the bigger picture. And that's so incredibly important. And this reminded me, his talk reminded me of a talk I heard a number of years ago by Larry Yellowbird, who is, he's a social scientist. I forget exactly what he is. He's affiliated with a university up in the Northwest, and he's a member of an indigenous tribe up in the Northwest, Washington, Canada. And he talks about the neurodecolonization of the mind. And I remember his talk was really powerful because it talked about contemplative practices which activate parts of the brain, which activate empathy and compassion. And when those parts of the brain aren't activated, there's no empathy, there's no compassion. And that is when it's really easy to be cruel, because it's really easy to distance ourselves from other human beings. There's no connection. There's no awareness that we are interrelated in some way, shape, or form. All human beings are related somehow, because we all are human beings. And so to pursue a contemplative practice, or to pursue a meditative practice, a mindfulness practice, is to begin to move towards this evolution, so to speak, of or to activate those parts of the brain that allow for this connectivity, this empathy, this compassion. He says that when he talks about neurodecolonization, it talks about weakening the habitual patterns that we've been taught societally, familially, and it's the idea that healthy, constructive thoughts, emotions, and behaviors can change our brains and lives for the better, and that mindfulness approaches are important components of physical, emotional, behavioral, and spiritual well-being. Mindfulness approaches and contemplative indigenous practices can train the mind and positively change the structure and function of the brain. You know, and Buddha's Brain by Rick Hansen talks about this also. So these meditative practices support this growth of kindness and supports us moving away from a practice of cruelty, from a practice of othering. That's absolutely what the Buddha taught. This is absolutely what the Buddha taught. Sitting down, practicing mindfulness. And when that happens, and because of this practice, there's this natural flowering of the divine abodes, the loving kindness, the compassion, the appreciative joy, the equanimity, which is what the Buddha said we should rest in. We rest with a mind imbued with these four qualities. You're probably all familiar with the practices of, you know, reciting phrases about metta, may you be happy, may I be happy, and we send them out to various people. But that's a little bit of a later tradition. It's really helpful because oftentimes we're so stuck, we're so conditioned in a really challenging way. We're stuck in beliefs about ourselves. We're stuck in beliefs about others. We're stuck in emotions. We're stuck in some kind of a trauma experience that it's helpful to have a specific meditative practice. But in the Buddhist teaching, it's like it's this natural flowering that happens, which is what, you know, Larry Yellowbird was talking about. These mindfulness practices allow the flowering of kindfulness and compassion and empathy, these mirror neurons where we begin to recognize other human beings as connected, where we're not, it's less easy to dehumanize others. It's less easy to cause harm because we recognize what's going on. And I've heard over the years, and I'm not sure who said it, I don't have a quote, but it said that if you're truly, truly, truly mindful, if you are absolutely in the moment and have been able to let go of this I, me, mine, and you and yours, this distinction, You know, the Buddha taught no self, the conditioned self. If we can let go of all that conditioning, we will never cause harm because we see, we have this clarity of what it does. You know, one of my favorite suttas, the Raja Sutta, the Buddha says, we recognize that we care for ourselves, and just as we care for ourselves, all beings care for themselves, so we would never cause harm to them. And another sutta, he says, we put down our weapons and we greet the world with kindness and compassion. The second factor of the Eightfold Path is wise intention. Our intention is to move through the world with kindness and compassion. It also includes renunciation. We put down those things that cause suffering. We let go and let be those things that cause suffering to ourselves or others. So the Buddha's teachings are full of this invitation to be fully present with kindness, to allow that to be how we move through the world. And I was talking to a friend earlier in the week. She's also a teacher. And I was talking to her about metta. And she reminded me that the Metta Sutta, where the Buddha offered this teaching, this sutta about what one should do, how to live in kindness, is actually a protection. And I had forgotten that. If you're not familiar with the story, the Buddha told a group of monks to go into the forest and meditate. And they did. And when they got to the forest, there were devas, otherworldly spirits, living in the trees. And at first, the devas were really happy these monks were here. But then the monks just stayed there. And the devas got kind of annoyed with these monks, like, camped out. And so they decided to, you know, scare the monks away. And so there were, it's like all of a sudden the forest became haunted. There were all these noises and winds blowing and bizarre occurrences. So the monks just like went running back to the Buddha and said, we're scared. We don't know what to do. And so the Buddha gave them the Metta Sutta. And it said in Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness, which is really fabulous, she talked about, she said, the inner meaning of the story is that a mind filled with fear can be penetrated by the quality of loving kindness. But a mind that is saturated by loving kindness cannot be overcome by fear. Even if fear should arise, it will not overpower such a mind. That's a protection against fear. It's a protection against all these difficult emotions, fear, anger, jealousy, all the things that are not wholesome or beneficial. If we are grounded in kindness, if we recognize we don't have to other anyone else, we don't have to judge, we don't have to do anything, we recognize this humanity, there's a protection in that. We've dropped the I, me, my, they and you and them, and can just be. And I'll just offer a few lines from the Metta Sutta because it's so incredibly powerful. The Buddha doesn't mince words. And this is what he sent the monks back to the forest, and they all lived happily ever after. He said, wishing, this is like a third of the way down, he said, wishing in gladness and in safety, this is what you should do, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, omitting none. You know, may all beings be at ease, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state, let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths, outward and unbounded. So that's pretty simple language. Not easy, but simple. Don't cause harm to anyone. Radiate kindness to all beings. All beings. And it's powerful because metta, loving kindness, these four qualities of the heart, compassion, equanimity, appreciative joy, they are unconditional, just as the Buddha said. All beings. It's not bound to, you do this for me and I'll do that for you. You behave nicely and then I'll love you. It's all beings. It's and pretty challenging and pretty extraordinary to have this unconditional love. But it is powerful. It is liberating. And it's a tremendous protection. I often tell the story about John Lewis, the late congressman from Georgia, who was also very active in the civil rights movement. He was the president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and involved in the sit-downs, the first sit-downs in Tennessee and freedom rides and crossing the bridge in Selma, Alabama. And he had studied nonviolence before they ever did one protest or one sit-down. And he relates this one story. I don't remember the exact details, but someone was coming at him with, was going to hit him over the head, let's say, with a baseball bat. And he said he needed to connect with this human being as an individual, as a human being, not create and not other him, but find the suffering in this person that caused his caused this to spill out and want to hurt another person. All this hate that this person had, where was that coming from? And to have compassion for this human. That is a powerful practice, but a really amazing practice because we don't have to carry hate in our hearts, you know? We don't have to carry those really challenging emotions. I mean, the automatic response is if somebody's coming to attack us, we want to attack them. We want to protect ourselves. That makes absolutely perfect sense, but not to carry hatred, to see that humanity in that person, whether they've done the work or not. We are doing the work. When we sit on the cushion, when we listen to these teachings, when we read the suttas, when we listen to podcasts and we practice letting go. We practice of recognizing those stories that have got their claws into us and have you know, kind of run our lives for so many years. When we're willing to let those go and not pick them up, there's a tremendous freedom. I went to a talk this morning given by Sister Clear Grace Dayananda, I think, yeah, Clear Grace Dayananda, who's this amazing nun. She's, I think, practiced in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, and she lives in a van, and she travels all over the country, and she says, I want to go where the suffering is and experience, you know, and really come face to face with that suffering and let it go. So all these emotions come up. That's what the Buddha says. You know, we don't turn away from anything. We live in this world with no preference. We are with what is, but we don't, what does she say? We don't pick up the stick of self and create this other. We can just be. And ask the question, what's happening right now? And right now, we're okay. We can let these stories whirl around in our minds about what he said and she said and they did and they this and that. But where are we right now? Right now, we're fine. In this moment, I'm sitting in a cool room looking at some beautiful people in this lovely Zoom mosaic. And it's okay right now. And to be able to touch into that is so important. And to reconnect with that sense of kindness for all beings. It's powerful. It takes work, but it's powerful. I was in a the Atlanta airport once. I think I was in a layover, and I tend to get judgy when I'm in places like that, very large places with a lot of people. And I sit there and I judge, why do you need that big a suitcase? Why are you wearing those shoes? You're traveling in that. I mean, it just starts going. And then all of a sudden I realized that's cruel. I don't even think I realized that was cruel. I mean, I have since looking back on that. That's cruel. That's judging. But what I did recognize, I had been working with this or had been with a teacher or had been in a class, and what I realized is, oh, I forgot. I love all of you. I love all of you. And I was able to let go of that judgy voice. It comes back. But then I hopefully can replace it with the, I forgot, I love you. I don't want to other. It doesn't mean, and this is important, and I think I say this all the time, it doesn't mean we don't hold people accountable for harms that are caused. Absolutely. But I don't want to keep that meanness in my heart. I don't want to have that cruelty. I hopefully have moved to a place of empathy and compassion. Starting with myself, I remember years ago being on a retreat when I first was able to tap into some compassion for my own suffering, which was mind-boggling because that was not in my vocabulary. And then the longer I was with that, and the more that became a part of how I move through the world, I'm able to have more compassion for others. You know that old saying, you can't love somebody else until you love yourself? That was just like a saying on a fortune cookie. Until I actually started this practice, actually started having an impact of retraining the mind, of activating those neural pathways, those new pathways in the brain, and shifting how we see the world. That's what the Buddha teaches. Rest in loving kindness, compassion, and joy and equanimity for all beings. And then there's another sutta where he talks about the advantages from living imbued with loving kindness. He says, monks, advantages are to be expected from the release of the heart or the deliverance of the heart by familiarizing oneself with thoughts of loving kindness. By the cultivation of loving kindness, by constantly increasing these thoughts, by regarding loving kindness as a vehicle of expression and also as something to be treasured. By putting these ideas into practice and by living them, this is what you can expect. Sleep in comfort, awake in comfort, no evil dreams, dear to human beings, dear to non-human beings, so your pets will like you. Devas will protect you. I don't know about this. Fire and sword cannot touch you. Your mind will concentrate quickly. Your countenance is serene, and you will die without being confused in the mind. There's an ease and an equanimity. The equanimity is the end of so many of our different lists and practices. It's this intimate experience, intimacy with our experience without preference. It's like this right now. Can I be at ease? Doesn't mean I don't care. That's not what it means. It means being at ease with this moment and recognizing our conditioning, our ancestral conditioning, the stuff that's in our DNA, recognizing the big picture. And working with all of that as we greet the world with kindness, as we greet the world with compassion, as we greet the world with joy. So, as always, when we look at these teachings and we reflect about how to put things in to work in our lives, we ask the question, what's getting in the way? Where are you stuck? If you think about walking through the world with a heart of loving kindness, what comes up? Or if you've tried it, what comes up? What get stuck, you know? And then when you investigate that, or you ask that question and you allow those answers to arise, or you recognize where you're stuck, then you investigate that. So it's, again, a continual, you know, getting down. And it's like, well, I can't be nice to that person because they treated me bad. Me, selfing. It's like, instead of recognizing that that person is just doing what that person does, and their pain is spilling out on me. All the harm I've caused in my life is because I was worried about me. I wanted to take care of me. I wasn't consciously intending to hurt people, but I hurt people because I was so enmeshed in I, me, and mine, making sure I was okay, that I trampled on others. And so that is what other folks are doing as well. And they haven't evolved to this loving kindness. They're still stuck in that cruelty phase. So see what gets in the way. And that's where the work is. We don't get around it. We've got to go through it. And it's all about, you know, uncovering and discovering and discarding. So thank you so much, my friends. And I hope this has been of some benefit. What follows are answers to questions. I don't think you're alone in that. I think that's a very common response. Absolutely. I mean, and to acknowledge the grief and acknowledge the anger, I mean, that's really important. That's really important. And then seeing where that comes from. This is, I'm thinking about this today when Sister Claire Gray, someone asked a question about this very thing, and saying that they had she was filled with bitterness over the Supreme Court decision over affirmative action, a tremendous amount of bitterness. And the response from Claire Grace was looking where that bitterness comes from, you know, just spending some time with that, because are you okay? She said, are you okay? And she's like, yeah, I'm okay right now. And so that's a big thing to rest with. That's a real big thing to rest with. But to recognize that those things are arising, not to discount the bitterness or the jealousy or the anger or the fear or whatever it is, but how do we work with it? Because that, we don't want to be driven from that. I don't want those really not beneficial emotions to drive my life. That's, you know, and these are things, these are not necessarily easy concepts, and they're things that we have to sit with and reflect on. Absolutely. And because for me, I'm totally committed to this practice. I'm totally committed to the Eightfold Path as a way of life. And so if the Eightfold Path is that we greet the world with loving kindness and compassion, how do I do that? And when right. something like this gets in the way, how do I work with that? That's the practice. Instead of saying how, you know, instead of going, this is terrible, I'm never going to be able to do this. It's like, make it more personal. Yeah. Thank you for visiting Undefended Dharma. These teachings are freely offered. However, if you would like to make a donation to help support the technology that makes these podcasts possible, please visit marystankavich.org/support. Thank you.